Welcome to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Coplin. Featuring out and about, thought-provoking conversations on the street. We consider topics with local relevance and global significance. And now, here's your host for It's a Question of Balance, Ruth Coplin.
Welcome to the show where we balance the intellectual with the creative and explore whether we have more in common than divides us through thought-provoking conversations. For the Arts Hour, I feature in-depth interviews with local, national and international guests from all areas of the arts. And for this, the Topic Hour, I feature interviews on a wide variety of different subjects that affect us all, both locally and globally. And the show combines a debate topic with an arts interview because discussion and creativity, I feel, are two of the most vital ways we engage with the world. Now, usually for the Topic Hour, I go out and about and talk to people on the street. However, for this week's topic, I'm breaking with that format slightly and featuring special guests. This week, we're considering, are we innocent till proven guilty or guilty till proven innocent? Is justice really just? We generally have faith in the justice system, assuming those convicted are guilty. Even when someone is charged with a crime, we tend to think there can't be smoke without fire, and so they must be guilty of something, even if not the whole crime. Otherwise, they wouldn't have been charged, right? In reality, wrongful convictions are not statistical anomalies, but occur with worrying regularity for a multitude of different reasons. Some estimates state that 5 to 10% of the prison population may be wrongfully convicted, which is an astounding potential of 200,000 people who are innocent yet in prison. And this deeply worrying state of affairs is highlighted in a new book called Anatomy of Innocence: Testimonies of the Wrongfully Convicted, which, through a collaboration between best-selling authors and exonerees, tells the stories of those for so long who could get no one to listen. I'm going to be talking to co-editor of Anatomy of Innocence later in the show, Leslie S. Klinger. But first, I'm talking in the studio to Laurie R. King, who is a contributor to Anatomy of Innocence. Laurie R. King is a multi-award-winning, internationally best-selling author of 25 books, over 25 books of non-fiction and fiction, including the Mary Russell Sherlock Holmes series, the Kate Martinelli books featuring a modern homicide detective in San Francisco, and standalone novels, including her latest book, Lockdown, an intricate, character-driven, psychological suspense novel. Since her first book, A Grave Talent, which won the Mystery Writers of America Edgar Award for Best First Novel and the Creasy Award from the UK Crime Writers Association, Laurie has averaged a book a year, gathering multiple nominations for and winning many prestigious writing awards, including The Beekeeper's Apprentice being chosen as one of the 20th century's best crime novels. At this point, Laurie has over 3 million books in print, which is a testament to her huge popularity. Welcome to the show, Laurie.
Thank you.
It's great to have you here. And the mystery genre is so popular, partly perhaps because it's comforting that the mysteries get solved, whereas our own problems rarely get tied up so neatly. And the stories in Anatomy of Innocence show just how messy life can be. Yet, thankfully, in the cases featured in the book, the mysteries have been finally solved correctly. So I'm wondering how you first came to be involved with the project.
I'm friends with Les Klinger. He and I have done a number of projects together. And he and Laura decided that the way to tell the stories of these wrongfully convicted men and women was to slice up their tales as if they were chapters in a book. And so each of the sections in the book, Anatomy of Innocence, follow the chronology of a typical case. Now, obviously, there isn't a typical case. But, for example, if you have a knock on the door and you think you're being interviewed as a witness and it turns out you're being arrested for a murder, that is how it opens. S.J. Roseanne, bestselling novelist, wrote that story. You then have an interrogation. Sometimes interrogations are polite and well within the bounds, and other times they go off the deep end. Sarah Peritsky talks about that. My section that Les and Laura decided that I should tell is about a young man who was convicted of a dreadful childhood rape in an area near Chicago. It's in Illinois.
Yeah.
And my first reaction, as you started out by saying, is no smoke without fire. I don't particularly care to be involved in a case that, yeah, he was found not guilty, but in fact he was guilty of other stuff. And so, and I talked with both of them, both Les and Laura, about this, and to make it clear that I don't want that kickback. I mean, we all know about famous writers who've said, oh, this guy is really great, we should turn him loose and all the rest, and it, he gets out of jail and he goes and does something horrible. And I didn't really want that on my conscience. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
But in fact, looking at these cases and a number of others, the various innocence projects, they call themselves, that are across the country, are extremely careful about the cases that they take on. They look at the kinds of cases that are based on false evidence, on witness identification. Often the witnesses later come up and say, well, it didn't really happen that way. The kinds of evidence that is later overturned by DNA, as you would imagine, a lot of these cases that they re-examine change with the modern DNA techniques.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, my guy spent 28 years in prison. I mean, he was a young man when he went in. And he spent 28 years knowing that he hadn't done this. Now, if he had agreed to a plea bargain at the beginning, he would have been out many, many years before that. But because his parole was dependent on his saying, I'm sorry, I did this.
Right.
And he said no.
Yeah.
He was 28 years in prison. And all of the different cases that are talked about in here are that kind of case. They are
where they profess their innocence continuously.
Yeah, they are not just found not guilty because of some quirk of law.
Right.
But these are people who really did nothing.
Yes.
Except trust the system.
Yeah. Well, there is, I think, it's a very strong thing within us, isn't it? Because you know, just as you're sort of speaking, and when I first came to the book, you know, you're kind of just thinking, well, how can this really happen? You know what I mean? And how would somebody do a false confession? Why would anyone do that if you didn't do something, you know? And why would witnesses say that they saw someone when they didn't really? And, you know, we have a very strong pushback against thinking that any of these things can let us down, don't we?
Yeah. And I think that it has been in the news enough recently that we sort of can take into our heads that, yeah, young black men are very vulnerable to being found guilty of something they didn't do. But in fact, if you look at the characters in this book, they're not all young black men.
No.
There's white women in there too. Which basically boils down to it can happen to anyone.
Yes. Yeah. Before you became involved with this project, I mean, did you have much awareness or knowledge of this kind of injustice?
Only in a very general sense. I think that most of us, I mean, I'm sort of a middle class white woman, and it doesn't really seem like part of my world that somebody would have that gross a miscarriage of justice just drop out of the heavens on them.
Yeah.
You always, as you said, you always feel they must have done something to draw the attention of the authorities.
Yes.
And it doesn't happen that way.
No. Yeah. And I mean, even if you, as you said, your person was guilty of some other things, but I mean, that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to do something else, does it? I mean, that's why pre-existing convictions are not allowed, you know, in cases that are being tried, because each case has to be judged on its individual merit.
Yeah. Yeah. And for example, the first woman in the book, she's a law student when the knock comes on the door.
Right. Yeah.
Now, you can't get much more innocuous and insider than that, can you?
No. I mean, it's quite frightening, actually, isn't
it?
You know, you read these stories and you're like, oh, my goodness, that really could be me. You know, I mean, I don't know whether there is a leaning, do you think, that socioeconomically, does it lean more to, you know, people who are poorer and being more because of the legal representation, mostly?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Right.
And I think that, you know, that especially minorities and the poorer sections of minorities tend to have less of a cushion between themselves and the machine.
Right.
And I mean, it seems to me there's a certain degree of lovely innocence in these people that you see in the early stages.
Of just trusting that it'll all work out.
Yeah. I mean, Ray Towler, the fellow that I write about in there, I had a couple of long conversations with him. And basically, all these years later, he's still really shocked that his obvious innocence was not recognized. He simply could not believe that they could find him guilty of anything because he didn't do anything. He wasn't there. He didn't do it. He wouldn't have done it. He was home. And all of these things that should have kicked him out didn't. And he could not believe that the jury would find him guilty until it did.
And I think, I mean, I don't know if you know, television also doesn't help in the respect that, you know, on so many dramas that you see, you know, that the police are, when anyone says they're innocent in prison, they're like, yeah, you and everyone else, you know, kind of like everyone who's in prison says they're innocent, you know, which I don't think that is actually even true, but it certainly creates this kind of myth that everybody's professing their innocence, but actually they're all, you know, cynically guilty.
Yeah. I have a feeling that inside the walls of a prison, that there's an awareness of who did what they are accused of and who didn't.
Yeah, I would imagine so too. Yes, yeah. Well, if you just joined us, you're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Coplin, and my special guest, best-selling author Laurie R. King. We're talking about the new book, Anatomy of Innocence, which features true stories of the wrongfully convicted. As a society, we rely on the justice of innocent till proven guilty, but in too many cases, is it guilty till proven innocent? Is justice really just? We're going to go to a break now, but we'll be back with more conversation after these messages.
Like the music from It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Coplin? Have you ever wondered what the full songs sound like? Now you can find out by listening to the new EP, It's a Question of Balance Music, available from iTunes, Amazon, and itsaquestionofbalance.com.
No white horses to play the game, and I wish I knew your name. Something about you in the rain. Did I or didn't I say it's forever? Well, I know I said it, babe, it just goes nowhere. Well, we can do the things we want. We can do the things we like. But if we're taking all the time, well, I just don't think that it's right.
there's more to us than just that.
It's a question of balance music. Download individual tracks or the whole EP from iTunes, Amazon, or itsaquestionofbalance.com.
Hi, I'm Casey, and I'm the second generation owner of Bookshop Santa Cruz. We pride ourselves on being Santa Cruz's community bookstore. We feature an extensive selection of new and used books, children's books and toys, gifts, cards, magazines, and games. Our knowledgeable booksellers can help you find just the right book or gift. We hope you can join us for our author events each week, featuring best-selling authors and books of local interest. And if you can't get downtown, our website has over 3.2 million titles, which ship directly to your home. We even have experts on site to help you publish your own book or family history. Come visit us downtown or at our website, bookshopsantacruz.com.
Bookshop Santa Cruz is celebrating 50 years of independent bookselling in the community that we love. Visit Bookshop Santa Cruz downtown and join in the festivities as we celebrate our customers and the books that make it all possible. Bookshop Santa Cruz, celebrating an amazing 50 years in downtown Santa Cruz.
Welcome back. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland. In the break there, we heard from Bookshop Santa Cruz, and I wanted to let you know that they have a great event coming up on Tuesday, September the 19th, featuring unique young novelist Robin Sloan and his much-anticipated new novel, Sourdough. In the new book, Robin Sloan does for the world of food what he did for the world of books in Mr. Penumbra's 24-hour bookstore. This is a great opportunity to learn in person from the author Robin Sloan about this intriguing, intelligent story whilst relaxing and enjoying tasty treats generously provided by Companion Bake Shop for this free event. So that's Tuesday the 19th at 7 p.m. at Bookshop Santa Cruz. Well, back to my guest this week, award-winning best-selling author Laurie R. King. If you just joined us, we're talking about the new book, Anatomy of Innocence, Stories of the Wrongfully Convicted, a collaboration between best-selling authors and exonerees to which Laurie is a contributor. So each of the... Oh, sorry.
You wanna... I should also mention that in case you haven't read it yet, Ruth, the Robin Sloan book is fabulous, the Sourdough book.
Oh, I haven't read it. Oh, that's good to know.
and like the other one, it has a glow-in-the-dark cover.
Oh. Very exciting. Oh, I know. Well, I shall definitely have to go along to that then and check it out. Thank you for the recommendation. Mm-hmm. So back to Anatomy of Innocence. Each of the exonerees' tales in the book is told by a different high-profile mystery or thriller writer. I'm wondering what you feel are the benefits of famous authors telling the stories of these exonerees.
For one thing, obviously, having names like Lee Child, Sarah Paresky on the cover draws the eye. And there's no doubt that in a busy... book market,
right? Yes.
You have to snatch the eye. It also means that when you assign a section of the story to each writer, they understand how to do the dramatic arc of that chapter.
Mm.
Because in writing a book that has 15 chapters,
mm.
you need to make that complete in of itself, because that's the only appearance of that particular character.
That was a really interesting aspect of the book, I felt, yeah. Is that you only get one tiny part of each person's story, but mm-hmm. by getting the tiny part of each of all of them, you get a complete sort of beginning to end yeah. of, mm-hmm. a combined story, if you like.
They could have chosen to tell half a dozen stories, or even all 15, just in only 10 pages each.
Yes.
But
yeah.
I don't think it would have been as effective. I think the fact that you're looking at different people, different crimes, different places, different times, different problems in the judicial system, it really brings to life exactly what they're talking about when they're talking about wrongful convictions.
Yes, yeah. And I think also, there could be a sort of certain... being completely honest, fatigue with reading 15 complete stories, instead of which you get these vignettes of a certain aspect. And then I liked at the end of the chapter, it does sort of tell you more of, you know, in a succinct way, kind of the rest of their story and how it came about. How did you go about researching your particular person, Ray Towler?
When Les asked me if I would do the section on the murder, which is the third chapter, the trial itself.
Right.
Sorry, not the murder, the trial.
Right, yeah.
I said I would be happy to do whatever section they wanted, but I didn't know if I could write about a trial without the transcript. And of course, this is something that's 30, 35 years old.
Yeah.
And people, governments keep records. On the other hand, finding them isn't always easy.
Right, yeah.
So
yeah.
I said I wasn't sure that I could do it without the transcript because, you know, how do you know exactly what is going on and what the problems were if it's all secondhand?
Yeah. And obviously you're used to doing a lot of research for your own books.
And my background is I'm what they call a recovering academic. my impulse is to go to primary source material, and that is the literal transcript of these trials,
right,
the typos and all.
Yeah.
So they finally found it for me. And fortunately for me, it was a short trial, not necessarily for Ray and for the course of justice, but the whole trial transcript itself only covered 3.5 days, I think it was, including a day of jury selection. So there wasn't an awful lot of material that I needed to absorb.
Right, yes.
But I found it fascinating because my background is not law. I don't know that I've ever looked at a complete trial transcript before. And I would not have thought that you could tell so much about the subtle undercurrents and personality clashes that are going on in a courtroom by this straight transcript. It looks kind of like a...
Because you'd think it was pretty dry, really.
You would think. And it looks very like a, you know, a script, because it's formatted the same way. It's almost all dialogue. Every so often, the transcriber, the stenographer, would make note of somebody nodding or something happening.
Yeah.
But for the most part, it's just dialogue. And you would think that that would be hard to really understand. But in fact, it was fascinating because as I read it, I could see that the lawyer that they had assigned to Ray was not on the ball. Later, I found that he was on the... He'd actually retired, and so this was just sort of keeping a bit of his hand in. The judge and the prosecuting attorney were clearly disapproving of him, disapproving of Ray. They cut him off.
Really?
And the way that the prosecuting attorney managed to suggest things under his nose to the jury. When I read through it the first time, I didn't catch it. And then when I read through it again, I thought, well, look at how these words appear, that he went from the defendant to Ray Towler. All but pointing his finger as soon as he starts linking it up with this really dreadful crime.
Yes, yeah.
And despite objections from the defending attorney. It got there.
Well,
and
once it's
lodged,
been said, it's been said, hasn't
it? Yes. And it was really fascinating, the currents that were going in this transcript.
Yeah. I mean, that I think is one of the things that I think seems to be even more of a feature, I would say, of the American legal system, is that a large proportion of whether you are convicted or not is very dependent on your legal representation. Yeah. And, you know, the manipulation of the jury, you know, when I say that, I mean, like you're saying, linguistically about how you throw things in subliminally or otherwise, mm-hmm. you know, suggestions and things like that. And I mean, that definitely seems very disturbing, doesn't it? Element yeah. of our system. I don't know how we get rid of that, but
you can sort of break down the causes of these convictions to a number of reasons. One of them is witness. Once upon a time, people thought, well, if a witness identified you, you'd done it. Mm. And in fact, witnesses are very, very poor at really remembering what somebody looks like.
Yeah.
The other is the kinds of police evidence that really is heavily manipulated. Mm. And there's poor defense.
Yeah.
Also this sort of fake science that you
yes.
throw in.
Yeah.
And Ray's case is interesting because it sort of has all four of them in there.
Hmm.
I mean, the police are doing this kind of very shady thing with the witness photographs. They display these photographs and, you know, oh no, we never pointed at it, but you can tell that there was a certain amount of,
yeah.
Witness testimony. There's two small children. I mean,
yeah.
They had a so-called forensic scientist, testify that a hair was the pubic hair of a male Negro. And I mean, how? This is the days before DNA, really.
Yes. Yeah.
And how can you? I mean, it's hair.
Hit anyone on that? Yeah.
It could be a dog hair for all he could tell.
Yes,
and
yeah.
I mean, all of these different things
yeah.
that combined to just yeah. dump on this poor young man.
Yeah. I mean, you spoke earlier about at the beginning you had misgivings about being involved. Was it these kind of things when you got more into it that helped you get over those misgivings?
Yeah. Yeah. You could see exactly what had happened.
Mm.
And the fact that when I really understood how the Innocence Projects work, that they don't just take any letter and say, oh, sure, we'll try this one.
Right.
They really look very, very carefully before they take on anyone.
Yes.
Because obviously you're going to have people who just think, well, it's worth a try. I can get off. But no, they are very, very cautious about that. And the combination of things. When I looked at the trial transcript, I could see precisely where the
yes.
dominoes started falling.
Right. All the authors in the book write differently. How did you approach telling the story as a writer? I mean, you've talked a bit about the research that you did, but what were your artistic choices for how to tell his story? You know, whether you did first person, third person, you know, those kind of things.
Well, it's third person, but I tried to get inside his head, and it helped having talked with him a couple of times.
Yes.
Not in person, but on the phone. Obviously, I'm not able to stand in the shoes of a 28-year-old black guy from the Midwest in the
yes.
80s. That's
yeah.
just beyond my experience.
Yeah.
But I can let his voice come through in my prose.
Yes.
And so when it starts out by talking about how incredibly white the courtroom seemed to Ray, that's his own impression, but it's my words.
Mm.
You know,
yes,
he kept
yeah.
saying things like he couldn't remember if there were any black faces on the jury, which kind of indicated that they were mostly white.
Yes, yeah.
He remembered a couple of times, he remembered that his lawyer always wore white cotton socks, which he always thought was weird. Well,
yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
But, you know, the fact that is both a factual and an emotional memory on
yes.
the part of Ray Towler
yeah.
gave me a place to start. This
yes.
is Ray's voice. This is his impression of the world. His innocence and his real conviction, if I can use that word,
yes.
that he won't be found guilty because this is America. I mean,
right.
this is my country. This is my justice system. And I was home with my moms. Yeah. And my two nieces, and we were playing around, and I wouldn't do that.
Yeah. 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 I mean, I think that's what comes out in the story. It's just his sense of how abhorrent the crime actually is and how so far from anything he could ever imagine doing. I mean, if you're going to be wrongfully convicted, I think that type of crime is probably the worst to be convicted of, isn't it? I mean, it's
and the
so
fact
awful.
That this young man felt sorry for the little girl who had to come and testify. I mean, that to me was an indication that this is not a hardened criminal. This is a guy who thinks, oh, you shouldn't make that poor little girl come in here and talk to you.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, what's happened to the people covered in the book is the stuff of absolute nightmare. How have they dealt with decades of professing their innocence and watching the best years of their life drain away? Is there a common theme about how they've managed to keep going?
It's one of the things that I think we all were impressed by our people that we were writing about was that they're not flattened. They're not hugely bitter about the world.
Yeah.
A lot of them are angry.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
And I think anyone reading the book should be angry.
Yes.
I mean, I'm angry when I think about Ray. You know, he was a simple guy who couldn't get a job in Chicago and just hang around.
Yeah.
And now he's an ex-con.
Yes.
Doesn't have any training, had never seen a cell phone when he came out of prison. I mean, what do you do?
And also, I was astounded to read in the book that there's more sort of services and things available to you as an ex-convict than there is if you've been exonerated.
Yeah. Yeah. One of Laura Caldwell's clients was dumped on the street with his clothes that he'd worn into prison, you know, decades before.
Mm.
In the pouring rain and no money in his pocket. I mean, there he was. And if he hadn't happened to see an old high school friend drive past.
Mm.
I mean, how is that a way of treating? And I think a lot of people are under the assumption that exonerees are rewarded with a huge cash settlement.
Mm. Yeah.
Well, occasionally there is a cash settlement. Occasionally there is a cash settlement that is promised and doesn't actually materialize. But a lot of states don't have it at all.
Wow. That seems incredible, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. You've said that ultimately the book is uplifting rather than depressing. What makes you say this? Because obviously it does seem quite, you know, depressing.
Well, yeah, it's depressing when you think of, as you said, how many 100,000 people are sitting in prisons now who really should not be.
Yes, yeah.
But the fact that human beings, really, we want to help each other.
Yeah.
That the system is beginning to recognize that it sometimes gets things wrong.
Mm.
I think when the Innocence Project first started, their battle was so uphill that nobody wanted to acknowledge that they might be right.
Mm.
And obviously there's a lot of that still. But in the years that they have been working and their careful choice of people that they represent, and the fact that they are shown to be not only people who shouldn't have been there in the first place, but people who can then deal with freedom and not go out and hold up a bank or whatever, that it has begun to turn a certain tide towards the idea that, there might possibly be innocent people out there that we should be helping. And a book like this goes towards that because you have 15 prominent people, more than that, who say, these are stories that you should be aware of.
Yes. Yeah, and all the followings of those individual people are hopefully, you know, being brought to it, like you said, and the more public awareness. Well, if you just joined us, you're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Coplin, and my special guest this week, best-selling author Laurie R. King, talking about the new book Anatomy of Innocence, which features true stories of the wrongfully convicted. How can we make justice more just? We're going to a break now, but we'll be back with more conversation after these messages.
Ciao, I'm Luca from Tramonti at 528 Seabright Avenue, steps from the ocean. We are the authentic Italian pizza and pasta restaurant, serving also organic salad and house-made dessert in a friendly family-style atmosphere, indoor or on our lovely patio.
Tramonti is open every day from noon to 9 and later on Fridays and Saturdays. Come enjoy our specials every Tuesday neighborhood night and the best deal for a healthy bite at lunch every day.
We bake our bread and prep our fresh pasta and pizza daily. Beppe, Daniel and I want to say grazie to the Santa Cruz community for supporting us in the past 2 years. Allora, buon appetito!
Visit Luca and Beppe at Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue. That's Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue.
Can you imagine living without stress, anxiety, or fear? And can you imagine a life filled with harmony and inner peace? Is that even possible? The Ananda Yoga and Meditation Center in Scotts Valley offers simple tools to help you become more effective at work and more centered in the face of life's challenges. At Ananda, we offer yoga classes for everybody, inspiring workshops, devotional chanting, and Sunday services based on the teachings of Paramahansa Yogananda. Our teachers and therapists are highly trained professionals who work together to inspire a healthier you. And your first Ananda yoga class is always free. Visit us at anandascottsvalley.org or call 338-YOGA. That's anandascottsvalley.org or 338-YOGA.
You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland. I've been talking to best-selling author Laurie R. King. If you just joined us, we're talking about the new book, Anatomy of Innocence, Stories of the Wrongfully Convicted, which is a collaboration between best-selling authors and exonerees, to which Laurie is a contributor. Well, now we're going to talk to one of the co-editors of the book, Leslie S. Klinger, who is considered one of the world's foremost authorities on Sherlock Holmes, Dracula, H.P. Lovecraft, Frankenstein, and 19th century genre fiction. He's a longtime member of the Baker Street Irregulars and served as the series editor for the manuscript series of the Baker Street Irregulars, and he is currently the series editor for the BSI's biography series. He served 3 terms as chapter president of the SoCal chapter of the Mystery Writers of America and on its national board, and he's also the treasurer of the Horror Writers Association. He lectures frequently on Holmes, Dracula, Lovecraft, Frankenstein and their worlds, and teaches courses on Holmes and Dracula at UCLA Extension. He was the technical advisor for Warner Brothers on the film Sherlock Holmes, A Game of Shadows. Les's work has received many awards and nominations, and his introductions and essays have appeared in numerous books and print media. Les is also a lawyer practicing in Westwood, California, and is the co-editor with Laura Caldwell of Anatomy of Innocence. Welcome to the show, Les.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time to come on. And I was wondering first if you could tell us, we've been talking to Laurie about her involvement in the book as one of the writers of the stories. How did you come to edit the series?
Well, Laura Caldwell and I have been friends for more than 10 years. And I think, She thought of me as a person who had experience in putting together anthologies and doing sort of the mechanical side of things.
Mm.
Plus, I've tried to help out the Life After Innocence Project over the years with tax-related things. That's my day job. So she asked me if I'd co-edit it with her, and I knew very little about the subject, but learned a great deal and just so honored to have been involved over the last 2-3 years in putting this book together.
Mm. The Independent newspaper states in its review of Anatomy of Innocence, it's not just a justice system, it's a human sacrifice system. So long as someone gets put away for the crime, we don't really care who it is. Round up the usual suspects, find a scapegoat, practically anyone will do, preferably black. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on whether we as a society just want quick and easy solutions.
I think that's a bit of an exaggeration, but I think unfortunately our justice system is built on a spirit, on a morale that rewards convictions, rewards arrests and all that, and isn't necessarily justice is not the priority necessarily. It's about clearing the case and putting someone away. I'm not saying that the law enforcement officials involved in these wrongful convictions are evil or misguided. I think in many cases they've made honest human mistakes, but the culture doesn't really permit them to admit that.
Right, yes. Yeah, I was wondering about that, whether there is a reluctance on the part of the justice system and perhaps even wider society to admit mistakes, because, you know, everybody wants to feel confident that justice is done.
Right. This is, I mean, for many years, the philosophy prevailed that we had a perfect justice system. Nothing could ever go wrong because we had the safeguards of things like Miranda warnings and a jury, jury that would assure that justice was being done. But as we pay more attention to these cases, we begin to understand that things that seem to be the gold standard, like eyewitness testimony or DNA evidence or things like that, that there's so many things that can go wrong that we should be questioning. We should be wondering, are we getting it right? And in many cases, we're not.
Mm.
Not in every case. Certainly not in every case. I think if we look at the statistics suggested by experts, 5 to 10% of the prison population is probably innocent.
Yeah, I mentioned that earlier. Yeah, it's a horrifying statistic.
But that means that 90% are guilty. I mean, so I'm
well,
not,
yeah.
This is not a condemnation of the system.
Yeah, well, it does state in the book, for centuries, it says the principle of 18th century English jurist William Blackstone has prevailed in that it's better that 10 guilty persons escape than one innocent suffer. And, you know, the acceptance that when humankind is involved, there must inevitably be mistakes used to guide the U.S. justice system. In America, we think of ourselves as such a free and just country. I'm wondering why that attitude has hardened towards it being acceptable to have innocent casualties as long as we get mostly guilty people convicted. Of course, as long as those wrongfully convicted people aren't us. But
sure, of course.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you could come up with a lot of cynical motives, fear, and just sort of life is easier if we don't have to deal with those people. This is still a nation where we live in enclaves. We don't have homogeneous societies generally.
Mm-hmm.
We have black people living in black areas and Asian people living in Asian areas and brown people living in brown areas and so on. So it's sort of out of sight, out of mind, and prison is, of course, the ultimate secluder of problems. We've gotten those people out of our way.
Yes.
So it's unfortunately become an easy solution. We have a nation that has the highest incarceration rate of any nation in the world. And, you know, the numbers are just staggering to think about 7% of the U.S. population being in prison.
Yes, yeah. I know it. I don't have the statistics to hand, but it's something like 25% of the world's prison population are in America or something like that. I mean, that isn't the right statistic, I don't think, but it is astounding, yeah.
Well over one-third of the women prisoners, are American prisoners.
Wow.
And, of course, you said it correctly before. I mean, the prison populations are largely, not wholly, but largely brown, black, yellow. You know, that's where the prisoners come from, because, I mean, so it does become a racial issue.
Yes. As highlighted in the book Anatomy of Innocence, the reasons for wrongful convictions are various in the USA, including human error, racial bias, mishandled or misinterpreted evidence, overstretched or inadequately trained defense lawyers, juries swayed by emotion rather than evidence, and even false confessions elicited through torture. The scope of the problem in this respect seems rather daunting. I'm wondering how we can most productively start addressing wrongful conviction. I mean, obviously bringing the issue more to light, such as through this book, is an important step.
Right. That's what I said. My self-serving solution number one, buy copies of this book for your friends. I should mention that all of the proceeds from the book, all of the author's proceeds, are being donated to Life After Innocence, which is a program supporting wrongfully convicted individuals and other innocence projects. So this is not a self-serving statement when I say buy the book. But really, it's about raising awareness. I think that's the best thing that we can do, is to start to, as we used to say in the 60s, question authority. When you read in the newspaper or you see on the news that somebody has been arrested, start to ask questions about why, and is there really a solid bank of evidence against that person? Are we being impartial, or are we just reacting in stereotypical ways, perhaps?
Yes, so.
Hi, Les. This is Laurie. It occurs to me that the business of when you are a cop and you make an arrest, it is no longer your problem. Is that part of the problem of you turn it over to the justice system, and therefore all you have to do is testify?
Well, I think that's a good comment. I mean, certainly that's part of the system, is that it is out of your hands. You're not responsible anymore now for whether somebody's convicted. You've done your best. You know, you've found somebody that you think is guilty. Hopefully you do actually think that. And now, hey, it's not up to you if the system goes wrong and they're convicted on shaky evidence. I'm not sure how to invest law enforcement more, but certainly that is a disconnect.
I mean, I was going to say and ask, in fact, you know, whether you both think the responsibility for injustice lies with us all as a society rather than just with the individuals involved in the justice system, and perhaps involving, you know, more input by the police, all the way through to what you're saying about us as members of the public when we hear about something, questioning it, is part of the solution?
Of course. And it involves stepping up, and it's easy to say things like serve on a jury.
Yes.
You know, we all, I mean, I have to admit, even I, as a lawyer, regarded as, oh, it's a terrible burden.
Yeah.
You know, how do I get out of jury service?
I know. I've done a whole show on this because I think it's really, I'm trying to really encourage people to see it as a responsibility. And also what I noticed when I did my jury service sitting in court and I looked around at the jury and it's supposed to be, you know, a jury of your peers. I thought, my God, you know, you really want it to be a jury of your peers if you were on trial. And people don't really put themselves in the position of the person who's on trial, I think, when they have that attitude towards jury service.
Certainly in Los Angeles County, we've done the good thing, I think, of really tightening up the deferments and the exemptions. It used to be if you were a lawyer, you know, you'd get out of jury service because, hey, it was just sort of professional courtesy and so on. And that's gone now.
Oh, well, that's good. Yeah. Because I know, where we are, there isn't the money to pursue people. But anyway, I wanted to ask you or talk about also that another disturbing aspect of these cases of wrongful conviction is the fact that the real criminal is still at large. And I mean, this Absolutely. Seems an additional compelling reason to get the right person convicted.
Absolutely. Fortunately, some of these cases, first of all of the cases that we talked about in the book and all of the cases that are on the registry of exonerations are cases where, in fact, the wrongfully convicted person has been released ultimately. Many of those, not all, many of those came about because the true doer was found. Evidence turned up that pointed towards somebody else, someone else confessed, someone retracted evidence that exculpated somebody else, and so on. But not all. And so, yes, there are plenty of cases where we've never found the right person. Those are the frightening ones.
I wanted to ask you, Laurie, being involved with the project, how it affected you as a writer, what thoughts may perhaps have come to mind about the creative process and the power of the written word in this context?
I think it underscored for me the, as you say, the power of storytelling. I don't regard myself as a capital L literary writer. I think that storytelling is a noble profession, and I'm proud to be in that world. And I think that the idea of telling these people stories rather than presenting the statistics is what makes this a powerful book.
And I'm wondering, first, you, Laurie, what you hope people will take away from reading Anatomy of Innocence.
I agree with Les that the asking questions. When you hear about someone and you hear that they are saying they were elsewhere, that they didn't do it, that there's evidence that he couldn't have. Yes, there's cynicism of, well, of course, their family is saying that. But you should also leave a little corner of your mind to be aware that they could be telling the truth.
Yes, yeah. And I mean, I think this idea of, you know, bad things happen when good people stand by and do nothing, you know, to be more involved perhaps as a community and not so isolated in our own lives.
One of the wonderful stories in the book is the Arthur Miller chapter about a young man who was accused of murdering his mother, a shocking crime. This was back in the 80s, I guess, or maybe even longer ago than that. I've forgotten now.
Yeah. Les, we've got about a minute left.
Okay. I was just going to say, and Miller led a community effort of neighbors who basically said, we know him. We know that young man. He couldn't have done it. We're going to defend him and try and find the truth here.
Yes. Yeah. Which is, as you know, tremendously inspiring and what one would hope would happen. But as we were talking about earlier, some of these people are perhaps a little more disenfranchised.
Yes, no doubt about it. When you pluck people out of the black community or the brown community, in many cases, they have no experience with the legal system. They have no idea what to do. They're innocent.
Yeah.
And that's sort of working against them.
Yes, yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming and talking to us, Laurie, about your involvement. And
my pleasure.
And thank you, Les, also for
yes, a great pleasure.
And I encourage listeners to go out and get this book, as Les was saying. It's called Anatomy of Innocence. It's available at all good booksellers. If you are local to this area, then you can get it at Bookshop Santa Cruz. And the purpose of the topic hour is to try to ask questions that make us think. So I hope that might have been your experience listening today to this guest special on the topic of wrongful convictions and whether we can make justice more just. Thanks again to Laurie R. King and Leslie S. Klinger for coming on the show. And thanks to you for listening. I look forward to you joining me next time.